session number 21561, Reel 3.
John Hayes, Reel 3.
Yes, I had a letter from a chap in Belgium who was writing a book on Derna Airfield, which was B-70, the airfield outside Antwerp. And he was interested to know what we as a unit, 413, we were there for a while. And I was able, actually, after all those years, to set out the sequence of dismantling what had to be done to a Typhoon and then reassembling it. And I think he was rather impressed after 50-odd years.
What, the whole aircraft?
Yeah, well, taking main planes down, and the procedure was you remove fuel tanks and you done them in a certain order in order to transport the... You see, he wrote to me about a fellow named Squadron Leader Meersens. His interest was he was a Belgian pilot, and he crash-landed just outside Antwerp. And he wrote to me and said, was I involved in taking his aeroplane back to Derna? And this is how it all came about. And I said to him, well, I said, one thing I can assure you, I said, if Meertens, I think that was, yeah, Meertens, if he crashed outside Antwerp, we certainly brought him into Derna, because we were responsible for that area at that time. But there again, you see, this all went back to your training. The Royal Air Force training was exceptionally good. And all the chaps, their technical training, were extremely efficient.
You were talking, I think, about the breakout from Normandy?
Yeah, when the breakout came, you see, from Normandy, we made our way to Merville, which was an established airfield, Flanders, in that sort of area. And at that time, of course, the V1s and V2s had started, and it was so important that we got along that part of the Calais region to capture these launching sites, because they were starting to launch the V1s, particularly on London, you know, the doodlebugs. Anyhow, we got to Merville, stayed there for a short while, and then we had to move forward because Antwerp was about to be captured, and we moved up there. And Antwerp was captured on my sister's 18th birthday. So that was September the 4th, 1944. And we moved up outside there and we started to hammer the Germans there. We were behind with the type. We were with the wings then, a 146 wing. There was Gillam was the commander. Desmond Scott, he was with 123 wing. They were carrying several squadrons, you know. And, of course, the Typhoons were a mighty force, you know, and they used to hit the tanks, and of course the Germans, you read about the Germans, they didn't like these Typhoons. But then we moved to now the main airport for Antwerp. And we moved into an old fort. I thought they were Napoleonic forts, but I was told later on they were built later than Napoleon. But they were big circular forts. And there again, this chap who wrote to me, from memory, I'd done him a plan of the fort where we were, and he wrote back and said, your memory is remarkable. You know, I just remembered it because what happened, and when we got there, you see, we were talking about the Blitz earlier, I always seemed to meet up with somewhere where we were getting pasted, and what happened was the Germans got a fix on us at Derna, and they started with the V2s and the doodlebugs. So, of course, we were getting walloped there, and so was Antwerp. Antwerp got lots of... a lot of people were killed in Antwerp. Civilians were killed in Antwerp with these V2s and V1s. Of course, we got a lot. And I think it's the nearest I came to losing my life, I think, on that airfield. And on a Typhoon, when you're adjusting the ailerons, they're the controls on the wings... You have in these ailerons what they call trimming tabs. You can just adjust the trimmers so that it'll raise the ailerons and keep you. What you're trying to achieve is steady level flight. So with your steering column in the centre, that's what you have to achieve. Now, in order to do that, underneath the main plane, the engineer is required to put his hands up into two small panels, and there's a turnbuckle, you have to adjust this turnbuckle really finely. Somebody's in the cockpit and they're watching the ailerons, but they, you have a, what they call a droop. It just has to droop a little bit on them. And then once the chap is usually the sergeant, he was in the centre, Tosh used to share that, just a little bit up the other set now, and you need to adjust the turnbuckle slowly. Then you lock the turnbuckle and then lock it with wire so that it, the ailerons, the actual wire couldn't move, you see, that the controls couldn't move. And I was doing this, I had a toolbox, so the Royal Air Force gave you a toolbox which you could turn up on end and use as a seat. And I'm sitting under this. This was when it had been snowing. I'm sitting up there with the hands in there. And suddenly, the aircraft went in here and hit me on the head. You see, what had happened? A V2, this is the big fellas, had exploded. And as I come to, there's a shrapnel, it's sort of aluminium material, sizzling in the snow around me. Now you can't get closer than that. And I was saying, you're right, you know, what had happened, we'd had a close hit, you see, one of these blooming V2s. They were enormous things, they're bigger than blooming tanks. I saw them after the war. And that's about the nearest I got to. And I always write in brackets afterwards, near thing, you know, because just down the road, of course, I think about 400 people killed in a cinema in Antwerp. In one go, we lost some fellas, 8 fellas on the other side of the airfield. 8 of them got hit with a rocket, all Royal Air Force ground crew. They're all buried in Antwerp. But for me, I call that a near thing, you know. But Antwerp was a, we got a pasting there, they kept on. And then, of course, on January the 1st, the Luftwaffe had done their famous, they gave it a name. Something Targ or something they called it. It was ready for the Ardennes. When they started to push through the Ardennes, they started to attack us at Antwerp, because that's where they were heading for. This is von Rundstedt when he came up through the middle. And so we had a bit of a rough time. But also at that same time, we were being sent out up to Holland to bring in aeroplanes, or repair them. Wherever the Tiffies crashed, see, the crews would be away. But headquarters, I'm saying, the headquarters was at Derna. And Nellie Wallace was there with the engineering officer, Duckworth. And we kept going out to various locations to bring in aeroplanes.
Can you describe what happened to you personally on January the 1st?
Yes. Well, we'd started, there was a fellow named Bayliss, Sergeant Bayliss. He was an engineer, he came from Nottingham. And we used to make an early start. We were up in the fort, we were in this old fort, Napoleonic fort it was an old, really old one. And we went out, we used to be at the end of the runway, in a corner, this is where we worked. We had the Merton hangar over the back. And Sergeant and I were round the fire, around the brazier, warming our hands. Now, I told you that the Germans always had good dugouts, warming our hands. And I could hear the noise, and I said to him, I said, what are those lightnings doing over here? Now, they were twin boom aeroplanes, you see, I thought lightnings, they weren't Tiffies, I knew what they were. So he said, oh, cool, because the Americans had Lockheed Lightnings, see, they had these twin boom aeroplanes. Suddenly, there's this shell fire, rat-tat-tat-tat-tat. There's all these, the Luftwaffe coming in, sweeping up where we were standing. We threw ourselves on the deck. It's sort of one of your arms, done this in the Blitz, you know, in the gutters in London, when the blast was coming.
Walking on your elbows.
Yeah. Get a quick, keep yourself down. The sergeant said, get in there quick. So we went in, that is the two of us, we got into this dugout. Of course, we were under the fire, you see. The typhoons were just on the other side. We were just warming our hands on this brazier. We were making a cup of tea, actually. We had the old billy can on top. And went in there, you see. Well, when you're young, you want to be brave and all that business. So I said to him, hang on, Sarge. I said, I'll go over, because our lorry was over the outside, our Crossley lorry. I said, hang on. I said, I'll get the Bren and the ammo, you see. I said, we'll have a go at the buggers when they come back, you see, because they were doing sweeps, sort of, you know, sort of circuits and bumps and coming in on us. So I was just going to go out. Big fella he was. He grabbed me. He slung me in the back. He said, he used the language. You stay in here, he said. He said, and you go out when I say so. And that's an order. He obviously had taken control, you see. But, you know, you do these things. Anyhow, as he pushed me down in the shelter, a bloody shell hit the door and exploded. You know, well, they had these, you know, you get a wall, and then you get the, where you come in that way. So the shell had dropped there, or hit there. And, of course, if I'd have been out there, I'd been blown to pieces. So he never said a word, you know. I thought, God, that was near, you know. But still, at the same time, you get this, you want to have a go. You know, you don't want to sit like a, you know, I'd had this in the Blitz when you couldn't hit back. But I had a gun here, a big brain gun. I was going to have a go at the sods, you know. I was going to get it on top of it. It sounds a bit daft now, but this is what how I felt. And he wouldn't let me go out. And he sat there, and as it went off, what he said to me afterwards, he said, see, we'd had a party for some Belgian children, 100 orphan children, and all the boys had made a collection, and we'd done this in this fort. And he'd been Father Christmas, and him and I had an argument about I wanted to be Father Christmas, and he wanted to be Father Christmas, a bit daft, but, you know, we were, you know, looking after these kids. And he said, I'll be Father Christmas, and you can be my assistant, you see. So that was sort of, you know, a compromise, which I accepted. I had to. He was a sergeant. I was an LAC. So we're sitting there, and he looked up, and as the last lot come over, he said to me, do you know, he said, I think those German so-and-sos up there, he said, bloody annoyed, because we never invite them to our party, you see. Just a typical sort of comment, you know, from a fellow from Nottingham. And we both burst out laughing, I think, in the relief of the tension. He said, they're bloody well annoyed, he said. A decent father, because he was a good Father Christmas, and his assistant, you know. And then, of course, they went. So that was our near miss on that particular day. But I think the Luftwaffe on that day shot up all the airfields. They had quite a big blitz on lots of us, you know. Everybody got there.
Was this called B-70?
Yeah, I've got a book. It's in Flemish. I've got it in there, but I'm sure it's B-70. Yeah, B-70. Yeah. But it was nice. That became our sort of base out to Holland and things.
Had they done much damage on the 1st of January?
Yes, yeah, we did actually. We lost typhoons. They hit a few typhoons, you see. And if a shell exploded inside an aircraft shell exploded inside a tiffy, it used to blow the rivets, the outer skin, and you couldn't use the sort of monocoque construction. And if you got an explosion inside, it would push the rivets, the actual skin off with the rivets, you see, and of course it became useless. So you had to change that part of the aeroplane, put in a new fuselage. And they did, they'd done some damage. Truck's not too bad. It wasn't, but you know, but of course, further along, of course, on the airfield itself, they'd hit some of the boys who were out on the dispersal. The wing was there, see, 146 wing, Gillam, his name was. They called him Killam Gillam. He was quite a typhoon pilot, you know, he was the CO of the wing. And yes, they did, they'd done some damage. But yeah, we used to repair it and get on with it. Next thing was, you know, get on with the next sort of thing we were required to do. But from there we operated out into Holland, and when Market Garden was on, we were pushed up there to a place called Grave, that's near Nijmegen, up that area, as the army were trying to link up with the Paras up in Arnhem on the bridge. We were out there, I got sent up there with Tosh, there's four of us. We went onto a sandy strip, And but there were two typhoons there. We had two there. We had to get out. And we got them out, got them back. Again, you see, the engineers were at Arnhem. They were ready with all their mesh, ready to land a new airfield for us, right on top of the job. Just waiting. Once the infantry, you know, had taken control, they go in and under terrible fire. They go in and start constructing. And some of these pioneers, you know, I mean, they weren't very bright, the chaps. And I don't know whether I should tell you the story about them, but one of them, see, when we were in, it was a sandy strip where we were at this, but I remember this incident. And we'd kept away from the truck, and we put a tent up near a sort of sand dune for protection in case we got a sweep, you know, from the Luftwaffe, because we were quite close to them. So what we did was we put up our tent away from the lorry. What we used to do our washing, we had these 4-gallon tins, British ones, not the jerry cans, the British tins, and we cut all the top off, and we used to boil our washing in them. You know, that was our, and also when you went to the bath, you put one leg in, wash yourself down, and then the other leg in, you know, one leg at a time, sort of thing, in your head. But these 4 gallon, they were good. They were sort of mobile bath, if you like. So how we used to get the water heated was you put sand in them, and put some 100-octane petrol in them, and set it alight, and then you could boil up your washing on top of that. You see. So one of these pioneer fellas came up to me. He said, "Here," he said. How do you get that sand to light? So we all looked at one another, you know. The four of us sat there. So I said to him, don't you know Dutch sand? You can light Dutch sand, you know. It's not like a tome. Yeah. I said, Corblai, can you? So he went around the other side to do his washing. And there's him with a box of matches trying to light up this. Yeah, you know, I'll tell you that, but this is an incident that happened on that particular field. It comes back to me. But nevertheless, they were very brave fellows, all of them, pioneers and engineers. I take my hat off to them. Never thought twice about it. Straight in, bugger the Germans. You know, they were going to get that airfield down. They knew the importance of it, and they were going to get it down. Bulldozers they used to bring up as well. I mean, the infantry had hardly finished. Ah, oh, some great men. The British boys are good to be with. I always felt very safe with them. Am I waffling on too much?
No, please say as much as you possibly can.
Well, that was you know, Belgium. We spent the Christmas of 1944. And Belgian people were very kind to us, very good to us. And then again, I'll say, we used to have to go out from Durnau, out to various places, Tilburg, Sertogenbosch, Breda, these names, up near Goch, Cleve, up in that area, up on the border. Anywhere where in Enschede, anywhere where these aircraft had pranged, you know, we were there. And of course, you know, when they were trying to open up Antwerp, the port of Antwerp, that famous battle that went on at Walcheren, yes, where the HMS Warspite, they were all out there. And one of our commanding officers, there's a Scott, Desmond Scott, he was a New Zealander, he was CO of 123 Wing. He was at a place called Oesel. We were up near Oesel. And all these Royal Marines had gone in. They were trying to open up the Scheldt. That's the river, up to the Scheldt to try and reach Antwerp. And of course, what happened was that they had no air cover, because suddenly that mist, you get the Scheldt, you get this mist sort of drop on there. And we were all up at Oesel waiting, you know, for operations to begin. And these poor devils, they come over from UK. HMS Warspite, I remember that in the name of that, that was in charge, Ramsay, Admiral Ramsay, they were in charge of this operation, there was a name for it, anyhow, Scotty as they called him, he realised the importance of this operation, and all these Royal Marines and infantry were trying to capture them, and the Germans were just picking them off. There was a fortified embankment along there, and Scott went out in the morning and it was mist, and he made a decision. He went back to the air crews in the tents and he said to them, "Gentlemen, we're going." I mean, there was no visibility, was nil, but he knew if he could get a decent height and get over the low mist, he'd be all right. And he wrote a book afterwards, and he said that once he got above the mist, he said it was a beautiful sunny morning, and they made it because they were only a stone's throw from where the battle was going on, and they went over there and they took these rockets and pushed them right down the barrels of the Germans and saved the day. And he said what he saw, what greeted him was there was all these bodies floating about where the Germans had been picking off the British commandos. And he said he went in and they were putting these rockets straight through the slits of these they could fire quite accurately. And Ramsay sent a message to everybody saying how wonderful work the Royal Air Force were. But Scott remembers that. He wrote about it later on. That was at Ursel. We were up there when that was going on. And then eventually we went, but we spent the winter. Christmas we spent in Derna. That's it. And then what happened was that as we come up, we were preparing, because the next thing was the Ardennes, of course. We had to get over that obstacle. And then, the next thing was the Rhine. You said the big, all you had to pack in mind was my dad was at all these places, he was at Ypres and Arras. And I think of what he did. And my wife is German, you see, and her father was on the other side. He was in the German infantry, and my dad's in the Grenadier Guards. We're married, you know, but I'm just thinking, I used to think, well, those poor devils were there for 4 years, and they were only moving forward a yard or two. And I thought, we'd definitely get a situation like that. That was always at the back of my mind, that we didn't want to get a stalemate. Whilst we were pushing across France and Belgium and Holland, it was all, the game was good. Anyhow, what happened was, Nellie Wallace called us in. He said, we've had group headquarters. He said, a number of you can go on home leave to UK. We hadn't been on any leave at all, right from the word go. And then we had drew lots out of the hat. 4 days we were allowed, and I was lucky. And I think it was in the February. I was lucky anyhow, and it was February. And I went home and saw my parents, you know. And only 4 days. But when I got home, you know, you can imagine, bigger from an East End extended family. The word went round the East End, Johnny's home, you see. Now, I mean, it wasn't just me. I had a cousin on HMS Birmingham. My uncle had been taken prisoner at St. Valery-en-Caer. He was incarcerated in Hernfels, you know. I'd had a cousin who'd been shot in Stalag 4B. He was a Marine commando. So they were all living in our group. My brother was in Burma. They were glad to see somebody from the family home on leave, you know. I mean, all of that. Uncle Jim, he was away in the service corps. My dad was the only one there, but he was too old. And he was fire watching, you know, up near the City of London. That was his job. But not many of them got leave. My cousin, Wally, he was out in North, patrolling the North Atlantic, you know, on Birmingham. The other cousin was down on the Malacca Straits, down in, you know, with the Japanese. So all of us, you know, were away. I've got a list in there. I kept a list of all our family that served there, and the boys that served afterwards. But what I can say was that I went home, and yeah, we're not great drinkers. We don't drink at all. But and even so, you know, when they got home, they all gathered in a public house, Globe Road. And this was mother's suggestion. She said, let's go and see Aunt Alice. This was my Uncle Bill, who had been in Germany since virtually from Dunkirk, you see. He was in the 51st Island Div. And we all met up, the world went round, and we all met up in this pub, and it was rather pleasant. And there am I, I've got a kit bag and rifle. And, I said, well, I've got to go now because I've got to get the train out of Victoria, you see. Oh, we're all coming with you. So, of course, you imagine, we're all walking along Globe Road. Some of them had a few drinks, you know. They weren't drunk or anything, but they had a few drinks. They were all a bit merry. And in the district line, we all pile in at Stepney Green Station. And all on our way to Victoria, all making a fuss of me, you know. And when we got to Victoria, the concourse is full of Canadians, you name it, they're there. WAFs, Wrens, all the girls. And so the station master put on some dance music. And of course, my sisters were there as well, you see, they were in our group, and my aunts. And then they all started dancing. And that concourse, I've seen it at Victoria Station, about the clock under Victoria Station. You know, all of them dancing and singing Vera Lynn choruses. You know, and it was a wonderful, it's like, and of course, I slid away gently, and I went through the ticket barrier, he showed you paths, went through the ticket barrier. I was on our way to Folkestone, actually, that's where we're heading for. And these Canadians followed me along, and they're all the family waving through the barrier, Johnny, you know, good luck and all this business. And I got in a compartment, and this Canadian infantry got in, and they said, "Aren't they nice lot, those people?" He's saying, you know, these are my relatives, didn't know I was related to them. "Aren't they nice? Wasn't it nice of them to come and see us off?" And they'd been blowing kisses to my mum and all of them. It's a wonderful, you know, it's very fresh in my mind, isn't it? But of course, I sat down, and of course, the next thing is, I came back in my mind. I had this naive ambition to find my Uncle Bill. You know, we'd had so much worry because he had three children, you see, and my aunt, this was my dad's sister, she tried the Red Cross. We couldn't find out where he was, you see, and eventually we had a small card from him to say he was alive. God, I can't tell you the relief. But I said to my aunt before I went to Normandy, I said, "I promise you I'll find him," you see. And of course, it's a bit of naivety of youth, if you like, but when we did eventually cross the Rhine, I kept looking out for him. But I had a letter from my mother saying that he was home. And that night I said a special prayer for him. Do you want something?